This is Dr. David Mathewson in his teaching on New Testament Greek 3. This is session number 2, Cases.
In this lecture, we want to cover the case system in Greek. And again, in first-year Greek, if you've had a first-year Greek course, you've memorized the endings of the four or five cases. There used to be textbooks that taught an eight-case system, but that's pretty much gone by the wayside, and most agree that based on the endings, the formal endings, Greek has a four or five case system, depending on whether you think the vocative case is a separate case or has separate formal endings, or whether it belongs with or is a function of the nominative case. But there are four or five cases in Greek that you've learned the nominative, and then the vocative, whether that's a separate case, and then the genitive, dative, and accusative case forms. And what we're going to do is look at the major and the basic functions of each of those cases. Now, as I said, you can look at grammars and find up to 30 to 35 functions, for example, of the genitive case. So you can find many more functions if you want to look, but I'm going to introduce you to the ones that, number one, I think occur often in the Greek New Testament, and number two, are ones that I think are probably significant or tend to be more significant in when it comes to exegesis and interpreting the Greek text. And then I'd say three, these are functions that are closer to the actual meaning of the case itself as it occurs in different contexts. Now, if you remember from first year Greek, one of the things that is interesting about the Greek language that it shares with a number of other languages is that Greek determines the function of its words primarily by the endings attached to them. Unlike English, where, yeah, we do have some words, we do use endings at times, but we can say I walk or I walked. If I say I walked with ED in the end, that ending indicates an event that took place in the past. English primarily, especially when it comes to nouns, so when we're talking about the cases, we're talking primarily about the nouns and how they function in Greek. Greek primarily focuses on the endings, the case endings, to tell you what a noun is doing in the sentence. Whereas English primarily depends on word order. And again, you may have studied other languages, or your native language may be one where, like Greek, the function of a word in a sentence does not depend on where it occurs in the clause or sentence, but depends on the ending. So you get used to looking at the endings. And the same is true with Greek. As if you've had a first-year course, you should realize by now that Greek depends on the case endings to tell you what the nouns are doing in the sentence. And so you've learned the endings for, as I already went through, the nominative and the vocative, and then the genitive and the dative and the accusative cases. And so what we want to do now is move beyond that and focus more attention on what are the different functions, what are the major and the basic and most important functions of those cases in the Greek New Testament. And we'll start with the nominative case, and again I'll try to illustrate some of these as well. But the nominative case, and I won't go through all the endings. Again, I would refer you to your first year grammar or a good first year grammar that would help you to recall the endings, because it's important to identify what the cases are. But again, in Greek, we're not looking for where the word occurs in the sentence. We're looking for the case ending to tell us what that noun is doing in the clause or in the sentence. The first one, then, is the nominative case. And the nominative case has a number of important functions, and again, I just want to focus on three or four of them. If you want a couple of others, again, you can consult second-year type grammars. But one of them is, and if I can kind of illustrate a typical sentence might consist of a subject, a verb, a direct object, and an indirect object. A Greek or English sentence doesn't have to have all of those, but it might, a full-blown sentence might have all of those. The same is true in English. But, and again, with Greek, I'm basically just following a typical word order that you'd find in an English sentence, but remember, Greek does not have to follow this order. But a typical use of the nominative case is to indicate the subject of a sentence. And the thing about Greek is, as you also learn, the verb in a sentence will have an ending that tells you who the subject is. When you learn verb endings, you learn that there are first, second, and third person. I or we, first person, you plural, second person, and he, she, it, or they, third person. That is indicated in the ending, and often the subject does not need to be indicated in the Greek text. But when it is, you should probably sit up and take notice. Often the subject will indicate the theme of the sentence when it's there. Or when the subject is clear in the sentence, but Greek indicates it anyway, that can often be used to establish prominence or emphasis. So what you should do is when you see a subject, and again, here we want to move beyond just pin the label on the grammatical construction, but if you decide this is the subjective, or this is the nominative case indicating the subject of the sentence, that is, the entity that is responsible for the action in the verb, you need to ask the question, why is it there? Is the author switching a new theme, a new subject? Sometimes a narrative. If you have an actor that is kind of off stage for a while, he or she will need to be introduced, and you'll find the subject. So sometimes the subject can be important, but it will be indicated typically in Greek by a noun in the nominative case. Another common function of the nominative case in Greek is to show you a different kind of sentence. There are some sentences where you will have a subject and then a linking verb, which very typically is the verb a me, and sometimes it will be the verb ginomai. So, a me or ginomai, most commonly it will be a me. And in this case, the nominative case will be used for both the subject, but also for the predicate nominative. And again, this is only true with sentences that will have the verb a me in them. Otherwise, you know, if you have a different type of verb, you're not going to have a predicate nominative. But so you'll have a noun that will be the subject of the sentence, and you'll have another noun that will function as the predicate nominative of the sentence. And the verb a me, we call it a linking verb in kind of basic language because it links these two together. So in John 1:1, you find, and the Word was God. We'll talk about that text a little bit later in relationship to the article. But the Word was God. You have a subject, a linking verb, and then a predicate nominative in that sentence. And again, it's only in certain types of sentences where a me and sometimes ginomai is present. Now, maybe you noticed an issue with this. In this kind of sentence, we actually have two nouns in the same case. The subject and the predicate nominative both in the nominative case. And in addition, we've said Greek doesn't necessarily depend on word order to tell you what is what or what a noun is doing. So how do we know which one is the subject and which one is the predicate nominative in these sentences when, you know, when you have a subject and a predicate nominative both in the nominative case, and when we're not supposed to rely on word order, at least primarily, to determine what is what? Well, a grammar by Dan Wallace, actually relying on other research as well, has put together a very helpful kind of pecking order of rules to keep in mind when you see this. A lot of times, you know, maybe this isn't the best way to approach grammar, but a lot of times it will be really clear, almost intuitively, when you translate the text, what is the subject and what is the predicate nominative. You're not going to have a lot of problems, but sometimes you are going to run up against, well, what is what? Which one's the subject and which one is the predicate nominative? Again, Dan Wallace suggested at least three or four kind of principles or rules to keep in mind, and one of them is if one of those nouns in the nominative case is a pronoun, it wins. It will be the predicate, it will be the subject. No matter whether it comes first or last, if one of the nouns is a pronoun, which we'll deal with pronouns in a separate lecture, but if one of them is a pronoun, it will be the subject. All right? Another one is, if one of them is a proper name, it will be the subject of the sentence. So again, if you have two nouns and only one of them is a proper name, it will most likely be the subject of the sentence. And again, we're only talking about subject, linking verb, predicate, nominative, distinguishing the subject from the predicate nominative, because they're both in the nominative case and Greek doesn't necessarily follow word order. Another one, and I think Wallace said two and three are sort of interchangeable as far as their importance. But another one is, if one of the nouns has an article, it will be the subject. Again, remember the pecking order. So even if one noun has an article, if there's a pronoun there, it still wins. So this is the first one. If number one doesn't work, if there's no pronoun, then you start moving down and considering these other rules. But if there's no pronoun, then if one of the nouns has an article, it will likely be the subject of this sentence when you have subject, linking verb, predicate, nominative. I always like to qualify myself by saying likely or most likely or probably or something like that, because you start getting into language and you find there's often no hard and fast rules or sometimes exceptions. The fourth one is, what if none of these hold? Maybe there's no pronoun, or maybe they're both pronouns. You have two pronouns. Or what if there's no proper name? What if neither the nouns have an article, or they both have an article? Then word order is probably going to be your indication. The first one, the first noun, if none of these three work, the first noun will probably be the subject of the sentence. So those are some tips to keep in mind when you come across a sentence that has subject, linking verb, like a me or ginomai, and a predicate nominative. You have two nouns in the nominative case, and which one will be the subject, which one will be the predicate nominative. Hopefully these will will help you to, in most cases, determine, especially those ones that aren't obvious or you might have difficulty with. But even the ones that are obvious, you can usually go back and see these rules working with those. All right, one last function of the nominative case is, I just like to say, often with titles of books or something like that. So the book of Revelation begins, "An Apocalypse of Jesus Christ," or "A Revelation of Jesus Christ," and there's no verb. The word revelation is in the nominative case, and the idea of the nominative case as designating, or some would even call it the naming case, that certainly fits with the use of the nominative case when you have a title and a book or something like that, just designating the nominal entity with the nominative case form. So those are three common functions of the nominative case. Again, if you want to read about a couple of others, you can look at other second-year grammars that will introduce you to some other functions. But these should help you with most of them, and again, focus on the most significant ones. To move on to another case form, the genitive case. The genitive case is probably one of the more significant cases in the New Testament for interpretation. And that is probably why most grammars have more categories for describing it, because it does appear to be a little bit more semantically weighty. Basically, the main function of the genitive, the main meaning of the genitive, is to describe or restrict the meaning of whatever word it modifies. And the most common use of the genitive case is to modify another noun. And so the noun in the genitive case often functions to restrict or describe in some way another noun. It doesn't always only modify nouns, but that's the most common use. And two other things to say about the genitive case by way of introduction. Number one is the English word "of" is not the meaning of the genitive case. And I've even seen academic writings treat certain functions of the genitive case as if the word "of" somehow is the meaning. The word "of" is simply an ambiguous English placeholder, if I can say that, to translate the genitive case. Notice in Greek, all you have is two nouns put together, and one of them is in the genitive case. And it serves to restrict or modify the head term or the noun that comes before it, whatever case that happens to be in. But the word "of" is not the meaning of the genitive case. There are other ways to translate the genitive case. We'll try to point some of those out. But that's the first thing that I want to clear up, that don't think that there's something. Greek doesn't use the word "of." It just puts two nouns together, and "of" is simply sometimes a convenient way to translate it in English. But don't get bogged down with that, and don't interpret the genitive case as if "of" somehow reveals its meaning. The second thing I want to say is this is also important because in probably 90 to 95% of the examples in the New Testament where you have a genitive noun modifying another noun, it tends to follow it. That's sort of the default order. When the genitive comes before the noun, the word in the genitive tends to get even more attention drawn to it. Because when you start looking through the New Testament, you'll find that most examples, the noun in the genitive follows the noun it modifies. But occasionally you'll find it in front of the noun that it modifies. And again, when that happens, it tends to make it more prominent. and make it more, adds more emphasis to the noun in the genitive case, because it kind of violates the default order, the common standard order in which it occurs. So kind of a footnote too, you often will hear things like, word order doesn't matter in Greek. That's not quite true. Word order does not matter as far as determining the grammatical function of things, and you look at endings for that, but word order can be very important for determining other things, such as, you know, determining, is there a default order of words that when the author kind of violates that or goes against that, it's meant to draw attention to it or something like that. There are fixed word orders in Greek. For example, the article, we'll look at the article in a different section, the article always has to come before the noun it goes with. It never comes after it. So it's simply not true that word order doesn't matter at all in Greek. You can just throw that out the window. No, it can be very important. Here's a good example of it. So having said that, let's look at some common and important functions of the genitive case. Probably the most important or common function, I should say, of the genitive case is simply the descriptive genitive. And grammars will use different words, the attributive genitive or adjectival genitive, whatever. But the whole point is, one of the common functions of the genitive case is simply to describe the noun that it modifies, much like an adjective does. Hence, some grammars would say an adjectival genitive. But I just like to call it a descriptive genitive, where at its basic function, a genitive just describes or attributes a quality to a noun that it modifies. And a very common English example you'll sometimes find in Greek grammars is the phrase, a flower of beauty. And the word beauty is simply attributing a quality to flower, describing it, hence descriptive genitive. So that's one function of the genitive. Another is, can be important, but a common use is a genitive of source. That is, the word in the genitive indicates the source from which something comes. So, for example, if I have the phrase agape theou, here's the word in the genitive case, the genitive ending theou. This could, in certain contexts, the word theou could indicate the source of love. And in this case, you could actually translate it the love from God or the love that comes from God or something like that, if the context makes it clear. This is ambiguous by itself. There's other things it could mean. But just as an illustration, there may be context where this phrase, the genitive, would indicate the source. The love comes from God. God is the source of love. Another important function, and this is probably the one that gets most of the attention, is what is known as the subjective or the objective use of the genitive case. And what we mean by that is this. When you have, to go back to our illustration, so it's the same thing, and by the way, you know, just to kind of reiterate, I like to think of this phrase when I think of genitives. A genitive is a genitive is a genitive is a genitive. There are not different kinds of genitives. There's one genitive. They can just function in different ways in the context, and that's very important. So we're not talking about a different kind of genitive here. We're talking about the same genitive that restricts or describes the noun that comes before it. It's just now in the context, including the meaning of the nouns, the genitive can function in a slightly different way. And what this category means, and this is an important one to grasp, what this category means is, it's, first of all, it's used in rather specialized contexts. So this isn't one that you'll just, you know, pull out of a hat. Well, I don't know what else works. I'll try this. Or I haven't used this category for a while, so I think I'll try it. No, this depends on some very specific conditions. And the main one is this noun here. This noun that the noun and the genitive modifies, must be a noun that indicates an activity. It's still a noun, but semantically, or the meaning of the noun, indicates an action. So, for example, in English, the word hope, the noun hope. Well, hope can be a verb, too, but if I say hope for the future, that word hope is a noun, grammatically, but it still communicates an action. Or the phrase we just used a moment ago, love of God. The word love is a noun, agape, but it communicates, the meaning of it is an action or an activity. Or endurance. If I say the runner demonstrated endurance. Endurance is a noun, yet it indicates, its meaning indicates an action, in the act of enduring, even though grammatically it's still a noun. So the first condition is this noun needs to indicate an action or activity. When that's the case, then we can ask the question, what's the relationship of the noun and the genitive to that action implied in this noun? Is the word in the genitive performing that action? That would be a subjective genitive. It's kind of like the subject of the action in this noun. Or is the noun in the genitive receiving the action implied in that noun? If that's the case, it would be an objective genitive, kind of like the direct object of a sentence. So that's kind of what this function of the genitive, that's kind of what it entails. And again, that depends exclusively and solely on the context. It's not a different kind of genitive. You can stare at the genitive all day long, but until you look at the context in which it occurs, especially the fact that it modifies a noun that indicates an action like love or hope or endurance there's a number of nouns in Greek or English and other languages that they're grammatically nouns, but their meaning indicates an action or activity. And when that's the case in Greek, the noun and the genitive can be either the subject, the one performing that action, or the object, the recipient of that action. And the only way to tell that is by the context. Again, go back to that ambiguous phrase, love of God. In the right context, God, theou, agape theou, God could be the subject of that act of loving. Agape is a noun, but it indicates an action, the act of loving. God, theou, could be the subject. The love of God, that is, the God is the one loving, the love that God gives, the love that He does. Or, in the right context, love of God, God could be the object. Love for God, or I am the one loving God. And again, that depends exclusively on the context. One grammar has a category called the plenary genitive that says it's both. I would advise that you reject that. That's ambiguity is not a grammatical category. The context may not be sufficient enough for us to distinguish, but I doubt that the author is intending both subjective and objective at the same time. It seems to be more an issue of the context is ambiguous and we simply can't tell. Or maybe the author himself wasn't real concerned with specifying one of those, but to say that the author intended both at the same time is probably stretching the grammar beyond what it should do. Now, one illustration of this, the most famous illustration of the subjective and objective genitive is a phrase that you find in both Romans and Galatians. Pistis Iesu Christou. And notice Iesu Christou is in the genitive case as the U genitive endings, and it modifies the noun pistis. Now, notice that the noun, although it's a noun grammatically, it communicates an activity. In fact, it often nouns in Greek that communicate an activity will also have a corresponding verb form. Like pistis has the verb form pistuo, I believe. But faith, and most English translations translate it faith in Jesus Christ. Here's a time where you'll very rarely find the word of, that ambiguous placeholder in English. But pistis Iesu Christou. So pistis indicates an activity, the act of believing. No matter how you translate it, faith, whatever, faithfulness, it indicates an activity. So we can ask, well, what's the relationship of Jesus Christ to that activity? And this is where literally books have been written on this debate as to how we understand the genitive Iesu Christou. Is it subjective or objective? And again, the key is, the starting point is, this noun that it modifies indicates an act. So we can ask, is Jesus Christ the subject of the of the act of believing or being trustworthy or being faithful? Or is Jesus the object of the act of believing? And most of your translations, English translations, although there's some couple exceptions recently, most of them translate it as objective, faith in Jesus Christ. Jesus is the object of our faith, and the faith then would be ours. And so when Paul says you're saved by faith, you're saved by pistis, or pisteos, Iesu Christou, he's saying you're saved by your faith in Jesus Christ. Jesus is the object of believing. However, there's another school of thought that says, no, Jesus is actually the subject. And we should understand faith, pistis, not in terms of believing, as if Jesus didn't believe and he had to believe, but more in terms of Jesus acting faithfully. And so they would translate it, the faithfulness of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is being faithful. He's faithful to the covenant. He's faithful to God's intention to redeem humanity, to his work on the cross. So Jesus is the subject of pistis, pistis understood in terms of being faithful. So this is again, I'm not going to settle it here. I would just say that I personally understand the Romans and Galatians more as a objective genitive, faith in Jesus Christ. But there are others that would provide arguments for understanding it as subjective, the faithfulness of Jesus Christ acting or being faithful. So I just introduce you to one of the more significant debates that centers on the whether it's subjective or objective in this case. There's other examples that might not have the interpretive weight as this one, but it's still important to understand what is going on and understand whether we think it's subjective or objective. And sometimes it's really clear in the context, at other times it's not, and you have to do a little bit more work to figure it out. That's kind of what's involved in this category of subjective and objective genitive. Just a couple of other categories very quickly for the genitive case. Is what is known as the genitive of time. This is an easy one to spot because the word in the genitive case When you have a noun in the genitive case, the word will be a time word, like month or day or year or Sabbath or something like that. It'll be a time word. And usually, when you find that happening, the noun in the genitive is sometimes modifying the verb and not necessarily the noun. But it's easy to spot. Almost idiomatically, one of the phrases that you find within this category is frequently throughout the New Testament, you'll find the phrase night and day or day and night. Hemeras kai nuptas. And they'll be in the genitive case. Both of those are genitives of time. So just be aware of that. There's debate as to, we'll see that the date of an accusative cases can also express time. And one suggestion is the genitive expresses the kind of time. And that does work in some contexts, but at other times I think, like day and night, I wonder if that's just the way they said it. They just put that in the genitive case because it seems to always occur. Those two words together, sometimes alone, in the genitive case. But just be aware of this category. Again, you probably won't make a lot of exegetical decisions on it. Doesn't have the weight of the Jesu Christu genitive debate, but it does occur frequently within the New Testament. And then one other use of the genitive that I'll introduce you to is some verbs take their direct object in the genitive case. And again, to write out a typical sentence, one of the things you learned in first year Greek, and we'll see in just a moment with the accusative case, is most verbs tend to take their direct object in the accusative case form. That is, the accusative case can be used to indicate the direct object of a verb in a sentence. But there are some verbs, due to their meaning, that tend to take their direct object in the genitive case. Most grammars will, for example, Dan Wallace's grammar is a good example, or the grammar that I wrote along with Professor Elodie Emig. We have a list of some of the verbs that tend to take direct objects in the genitive case, and that's due to the meaning of the verb. You can also use a standard lexicon, especially the larger, what is known as BDAG, the Bauer, Danker, Arndt, and Gingrich lexicon, will often tell you in the entry for certain verbs whether they take direct objects in something other than the accusative case. A good example of a verb that takes a direct object in either the accusative or genitive is the verb akouo, I hear. And you'll sometimes find that with direct objects in the accusative case, at other times in the genitive case. And there's some debate as to what might be the difference. I don't want to go into that now, but I just want you to be aware that the genitive case can function as the direct object of certain types of verbs, not all verbs, but there are certain verbs that tend to take their direct object only in the genitive case, or sometimes in two cases, such as the accusative and the genitive. To move on to the dative case, the basic meaning of the dative case is relation. It establishes a relation between the noun and the dative and the rest of the context. And the dative case has a number of important usages. It's probably, at the level of its significance for exegesis, it's probably up there with the genitive case. And the dative case has a number of important functions. One of them is And the most common one that you probably learned in first year Greek is the a noun in the dative case expresses the indirect object of a sentence. So again, to kind of symbolize a typical Greek sentence, I might have a subject, verb, direct object, and an indirect object. So if I say the professor gave an A to the student, in English, to the student would be your indirect object, the one person for whom or to whom the action is performed. So a typical use of the dative case in Greek is to express the indirect object. We express it in English with, usually with the word to. I gave the book to the student or something like that. But Greek expresses the indirect object with a noun in the dative case. Another use of the dative case in Greek is what is often called reference or respect. And it's kind of a looser use of the genitive case, and sometimes you can actually use the translation with reference to or with respect to. And a good example of that is found in Romans chapter 6 and verse 1, where Paul, responding to a potential objection to his argument so far, says, should we remain in sin so that grace may increase? By no means. Do you not know, or maybe it's verse 2, do you not know that you who have died to sin, apathanen, and then te hamartia, in the dative case, te hamartia is in the dative, and it doesn't seem to be the indirect object. Death isn't doing something to sin. Instead, most of the commentaries and some of the grammars I read would see this as kind of a clear example of what we could call a dative of reference or respect. You have died with reference to sin or with respect to sin. And kind of a looser use of the genitive. Still, the idea of relation is present, the standard meaning of the genitive, but more of a looser use. We have died with respect to or in relation to sin. So the dative of reference or respect. Another use of the dative is the dative of time. We already saw that with the genitive case, and again, there's debate as to what's the difference between a genitive of time and a dative of time. Some grammars say the dative indicates looks at the time as a point that could be fit in some context. Other examples I've seen, I'm not always able to discern a distinct difference. But again, this one's rather easy to spot because, like the genitive of time, it is going to be used with words of time, whether day or hour or Sabbath or month or year. It will be used with a measurement of time. And when you see that, that's a dead giveaway that you're dealing with a genitive of time or, in this case, a dative of time. And then two other usages that I want to highlight of the dative case. Actually, three other ones. Dative of possession. That is, sometimes a noun in the dative case can be used to indicate possession. And here, often we won't use the word to, but if you often think of it in terms of the word to, you often find the expression in the Greek New Testament, he has a name to him. And him would be in the dative, auto. He has a name to him, but that would be a dative of a possession. It'd be better to translate his name was, the name, his name, so that the dative the dative can indicate possession. Again, only the same is true with the dative as with the genitive. A dative is a dative is a dative, and it always carries the meaning of relation of some kind, but in certain context, it can indicate possession. Another one to focus on is location or sphere. Sometimes a noun in the dative case can show the physical or, that would be location, or metaphorically or spiritually the location of something. And for example, I could say he was oiko, in the house. That would be a physical location. When someone is in a certain location, and often you'll use the word in to translate this, if someone is in a physical location, a noun in the dative case can indicate that. However, a noun can also indicate a spiritual or metaphorical location. And the most common usage of this that you find is Paul's Christo, in Christ language, where, or even in the Spirit, sometimes with the preposition en and sometimes without it. But in both those cases, in Christ and in the Spirit, that's not a physical location that you can find on the map. That's talking spiritually or metaphorically, to be in Christ or to be in the Spirit. To do something in the Spirit is a common usage of the dative case. But those are, you know, one way to look at it, those are kind of two sides of the same coin. It's just that one refers to a physical location. Nouns refer to a physical space. To be in that location, in that space, would be a dative of a location, whereas dative of sphere is usually used for more metaphorical. And then finally, is the dative of manner. Sometimes a noun can be used to indicate the manner, or I would add the word also, the means by which something is done. And these two are hard to, sometimes you'll find grammars distinguishing these, but I think they're often difficult to distinguish. So again, to use an English example, if I say rather gruesomely, is he killed him with the sword. With the sword could indicate the manner, how he killed him, or the means by which he killed him. It'd be hard in that context to distinguish. Sometimes you can. But often a noun in the dative case will indicate either the manner by which an action takes place or the means by which it takes place. And again, sometimes, at least in Greek, it wasn't necessary to, I don't think, distinguish those, and as will often be difficult to distinguish in your own interpretation. And then if I could add more, just so I get the number 7 here, is the dative can also, like the genitive, be used as a direct object. Some verbs prefer their direct object in the dative case. And again, grammars or a lexicon like BDAG will often help you to identify those verbs that take direct objects in the dative case. Then in our next lesson, we'll wrap up the cases. We'll look at the vocative case and the accusative case, and then also talk a little bit about pronouns and the different kinds of pronouns and their functions as well.
This is Dr. David Mathewson in his teaching on New Testament Greek 3. This is session number 2, Cases.